You know, for 3 million years, we've just been hanging out on Earth looking for carbon.
Sometimes I get the feeling that I won't be on this planet for very long.
Yikes. Environmental stress from 6 billion carbon-emitting people and their animals and power plants and campfires has caused humanity to consider a change in plans. The trouble is, changing the way we've been doing things is hard.
Don't change your plans for me.
Climate-changing plans, why humans just hate going green. Hey, the color looks good on you. Go change it on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Ben Folds, anytime on The Takeaway. Good morning. It's Wednesday, April 15th. I'm John Hockenberry. Adora Udoji is away with her new baby. Lynn Scherr is here with us, colleague from ABC, author, journalist. Coming up this hour, we'll look at the real people behind the recent Cuban headlines. You'll meet a young Cuban American with some pretty fascinating thoughts that you don't often hear, plus a provocative conversation about race and justice in prisons, and especially among drug offenders. All this and more, first headlines. Word of a new Somali pirate attack on an American cargo ship. Bandits blasted the ship with grenades and gunfire, blowing a hole in the ship and starting a fire on board. The ship managed to shake the pirates and put out the fire. Later, the USS Bainbridge arrived to help, though the pirates were gone by the time it came. The Bainbridge is now escorting the ship to Kenya. The pirate attacks are renewing a debate about arming merchant ships. For now, crews improvise a defense, like blasting pirates with fire hoses. Bainbridge Commander Frank Castellano says it's worth thinking about giving those shipping crews real weapons.
It's a very similar question that happened after September 11th about arming crew members on airplanes. And I think that's something that probably needs to be discussed.
Certainly it's a new day for piracy with these latest stories. Femi, okay, what else is going on?
Good morning, all. Staying overseas, North Korea is taking another step back from nuclear disarmament. It's kicking out United Nations nuclear inspectors. This follows Pyongyang's declaration that it will pull out of long-running six-country arms talks. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs wants the North back at the table.
The United States is prepared to work with North Korea and its neighbors through the six-party process to reduce tensions and achieve the elimination of nuclear weapons from the Korean Peninsula.
Russia has also called on Pyongyang to rejoin the talks. The U.S. Special Envoy George Mitchell is in Israel today. It's his first visit to the region since the new right-leaning government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And later this week, Mitchell will talk to Palestinians in the West Bank. We will be talking about Mitchell in Israel in just a couple of minutes. North Dakota is bracing for another round of flooding. The Cheyenne River is at record highs and it's expected to crest later this week. John.
Markets on Wall Street bouncing up and down. The Dow dropped 2% yesterday. It begins trading at 79.20. If you had a comment to make to the IRS today, what would it be?
This is Greg from Boston. If there were a place on my tax form to tell the IRS what I think of them, it would be that I am so pleased and happy to be sending in my taxes to those hardworking folks at the IRS, and I hope they never think that I would think anything other than that.
What's your comment for the feds on tax day? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We're following the piracy, more pirate attacks this morning on The Takeaway. Also, it is tax day, and is there a message in all those numbers on your 1040 form for the U.S. government? What if there was a comments page? Send it to us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. The way you do your taxes is a verdict on what you think about being an American citizen. But we begin with the Middle East. George Mitchell arrives today in Israel as part of his two-week regional tour as Middle East envoy for the Obama administration. And this is what he said about his appointment back on January 22nd of this year.
I form the conviction that there is no such thing as a conflict that can't be ended. Conflicts are created, conducted, and sustained by human beings. They can be ended by human beings.
And apparently George Mitchell is going to have to find the human beings that can end the Arab-Israeli conflict. Rosemary Hollis joins me now. She's an international relations expert focusing on the Middle East and director of the Olive Tree Program at London City University. She joins us from London. Rosemary Hollis, it seems as though George Mitchell faces rings of purgatory in attempting to end the Arab-Israeli conflict at this moment. Let me just identify three. First, there's the broad coalition in the Arab world, which George Mitchell is attempting to assemble. There's the brand new government in Israel, which poses its own challenges. And then there's the question of a single unified front for the Palestinians, which has eluded the Palestinians themselves since Hamas has taken control of Gaza and Fatah has remained in the West Bank. They're far apart. Rosemary Hollis, let's start with the Palestinians. How challenging is this for George Mitchell?
Well, I think up till now, and probably George Mitchell will do the same thing, up till now, the reliance has been on the Egyptians and the Saudis to try and broker a deal between the Hamas leadership in the Gaza Strip and the Fatah leadership and president, as recognized by the West, and prime minister, as recognized by the West, in the West Bank. But that diplomacy between the factions to see if they can join together to get Gaza rebuilt, to channel the money to rebuild Gaza, and indeed to enter peace negotiations, assuming they're on offer, that has been very difficult, tortuous process, and it's nowhere near complete or
Rosemary,
successful yet.
It would seem as though the opportunity to rebuild Gaza would come with it, you know, all kinds of ways of developing credibility with Hamas, that the quid pro quo involved in the kinds of investment that will be taking place in Gaza might, in some sense, be a bridge to dealing with Hamas politically. But it hasn't worked out that way so far. Why?
Well, there's certainly a lot of voices against any kind of legitimation of Hamas leadership in the Gaza Strip through the back door, i.e. through the disbursement of development and reconstruction aid. The Israelis hitherto have been dead against any kind of dealings with Hamas, although it's conceivable that they would negotiate behind the scenes through intermediaries over specific issues like the return of the captured soldier Gilad Shalit in return for some Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails and so on. But they have stuck with the idea that was championed by the Bush administration that Hamas could somehow be forced out of power and be marginalized if nobody dealt with the Hamas leadership. That has proved a false hope over the last 3 years, and now there are voices being raised for a different approach which would bring them into the picture.
Well, what is the possibility of getting Fatah together with Hamas in the sense that, okay, maybe the Israelis don't want to deal with Hamas, but can Fatah in any sense deal with Hamas? And is there any sort of intermediary, be it Turkey, be it Algeria, that could speak for both, even to get preliminary talks started?
Well, so far the Egyptians have wanted to take the lead in trying to get both factions together. But it seems that they recently referred the issue to the Saudis for their help. And Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, went to Saudi Arabia seemingly to discuss why he's objecting to an arrangement brokered by the Egyptians for dealing with the Hamas leadership. And Abbas's objection, which is characteristic of the old guard Fatah leadership in general, is that they don't want to share any power with the Hamas leadership. The rivalry between them is so bitter that they are jeopardizing the future of the Palestinian people and the future of any kind of peace negotiations in the name of trying to defeat one another.
Well, which leads us directly to the issue of the Israeli government now, which is sort of this second ring of purgatory I was talking about. You've got Benjamin Netanyahu in a conservative government, the foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, who has called explicitly for a rollback of any discussions of peace with the Palestinians. How much of a challenge is that for someone like George Mitchell?
It's a big challenge if you are absolutely set on achieving progress towards an independent, sovereign Palestinian state on the West Bank and Gaza alongside Israel. However, it perhaps is worth pointing out that where Netanyahu is coming from, and up to a point Lieberman, is in tune with the mood in Israel pretty much. insofar as they don't feel that now is the time to negotiate a deal because of the weakness and division on the Palestinian side, and also because of the cost to Israel. They argue that were they to negotiate away the West Bank, they could find themselves in the same position as they feel they are with the Gaza Strip today, under attack from Hamas leadership, with southern Lebanon today under attack from Hezbollah militia. And why on earth, they ask, would they be fools enough to give the Palestinians a new jumping off ground to attack them from the Eastern Front as well?
Rosemary Linshire here. What does George Mitchell bring to the table, and to what extent can he make a difference after, of course, what he did famously in Northern Ireland? Will they give him that same kind of respect? Can he make it happen?
He's certainly got more traction on the Arab side of the picture and across the region. And it's interesting that he is going to Israel today on the back of a trip which has encompassed North Africa and will in due course encompass other states in the region. He obviously wants to have the support of leading Arab states behind him to give ballast to the weak and fractured Palestinian leadership to overcome the Israeli argument that there's no partner to deal with. And because of his record, and because he was tough on the Israelis previously in 2001 when he issued a report on the situation and said that settlement expansion had to stop if there was to be hope of peace, that has got him supporters on the Arab side of the picture. But it has also made the Israelis wary.
Well, it's also the case that the potential very, very quickly becomes inertia in the Middle East. And just going back to what you said a moment ago, I mean, if the Israelis have no incentive to talk to the Palestinians as long as they're divided, then I don't see what Mitchell's in is here. I don't see what his wedge is. And some have talked at the BBC this morning even that there's a 22-state solution that Mitchell could pursue where you would get a broad Arab coalition to force some sort of a settlement. Could Mitchell take that route?
I think he is intending to take that route and to capitalize on the Arab initiative, which offers peace with Israel, recognition of Israel in the event that Israel withdraws from the West Bank and enables a Palestinian state to emerge with Jerusalem as its capital alongside Israel using Jerusalem as its capital. But in the way of that kind of deal are the settlers, who are all over the West Bank at the moment and in the major blocks along and beside the security barrier that the Israelis have been building over the last few years. And successive Israeli prime ministers have said they can't realistically take on the settler movement. It will split Israeli society unless and until there's such an attractive deal that it's irresistible. Well, that's a chimera. And this is the kind of thing that Mitchell can't overcome. But what will be interesting is to see whether he ends up having a real conversation with the new Israeli leadership about what are the alternatives to a two-state solution. If it's impossible, what do you propose instead?
Well, political weakness in both the Palestinian and Israeli communities is not helpful in George Mitchell's task. The question really is, will George Mitchell preside over the resurrection of the two-state solution or the death of the two-state solution? We'll have to sort that out. George Mitchell arrives in Israel today. Rosemary Hollis was with us. She's an international relations expert focusing on the Middle East and director of the Olive Tree Program at City University in London, where she joined us from. So, Lynn, complicated situation with no real incentives, it seems to me. Although the idea that the Arab solution, the 22-state Arab consensus, would be the starting point is a true irony here.
And the fact that, as she said, that George Mitchell already enjoys so much Arab support and would enjoy it. I'm intrigued by the concept of George Mitchell on the one hand, Richard Holbrooke on the other, dealing with dealing with Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Someone should do a score chart.
Yeah, yeah.
Holbrooke, Mitchell.
Exactly.
Who's ahead.
But it's about President Obama. It's all about can he do it?
Yes, indeed.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Kind of a special Takeaway Wednesday. Maybe that's what the government calls April 15th, Takeaway Wednesday. It's tax day, and in the numbers on your 1040 form, there is really a message there, and the government's able to decode what you're thinking about being an American citizen. But if there really was a comments page, what would you put on it? Do you want the government to spend your money on different things? Do you have an agenda you'd want them to carry out? Tell us your 1040 tweaks at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Okay. We're going now to Cuba. Cuba, how you see it may well depend on how old you are. If you were around during the revolution of 50 years ago when Fidel Castro took over, you would probably think Cuba is a dictatorship. But if you're one of the several younger generations of Cuban Americans who've grown up in this country, Cuba is, well, what exactly is it? Is it just another foreign country? Is it your homeland? How do you see Cuba and how would you see it? If you are one of those people who was born here to Cuban parents who may have come from there. The question is, are those young people prepared for the new job being offered by the Obama administration?
There are no better ambassadors for the freedom of the Cuban people than Cuban Americans. And that's why I have said that I will immediately allow unlimited family travel and remittances to the island. It's time to let Cuban Americans see their mothers and their fathers, their sisters and their brothers.
So, ambassadors. Yesterday, President Obama made good on his promise to lift restrictions on Cuban Americans who wish to travel there. But what about the people whom he's tapped to be those ambassadors? Do they want to spread the word or even go back? In the studio joining us is Danny Mendoza. He is a Cuban American filmmaker, a student at New York University's Tisch School of the Arts. Danny, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Do you want to go back to Cuba and be an ambassador?
I do. I personally do. I've wanted to for some time, and I'm part of a group of young people who are friends, just happen to know each other, who are Cuban American, who have, by and large, a great interest in reconnecting with the life on the island, the cultural life on the island, the work being done there. I don't think it necessarily falls to all of us, and I know a great many people who don't have very much interest in going to the island, who do feel it's just a foreign country to them.
Let me interrupt you for a minute. You call yourself a Cuban American. I refer to you as a Cuban American. Mm-hmm. Where were you born?
Miami, Florida.
Right. Where was your father born?
My father was born in a little area outside of Havana.
Oh, okay. So you're first generation American.
I am indeed.
Okay. So you call yourself Cuban American?
I do.
Do most of your friends, do young people whose families have now been here maybe two generations, do they call themselves Cuban American?
In Miami, yes. So there aren't that many who are in their second generation now. Most of us that I knew were first generation.
Okay. Have you been back to Cuba?
I have not. Members of my family have, though.
You know, you can see the conflict not big conflict, but I'm just wondering if this announcement by the Obama administration sets in motion conversations between parents and kids all over the Cuban American community where I'm going back, no, you're not. Yes, you should. You should. Is that what's going on now?
I imagine so for a great many people. My situation is not the typical. My parents, I believe quite confidently, would support my decision to go back at some point, do support that. But I know very, very many people who would take issue with it initially and would need a lot of conversing. They would need to really understand why I would want to go back in order for them to be able to be okay with it, to not feel that it goes against what they suffered or what they believe.
Well, you know, I saw there was a wonderful one-woman play in New York last year called Rum and Coke by a woman named Carmen Pelaez. She's Cuban-American. Mm-hmm. And her grandmother, the character of her grandmother in the play, says to her, you are not free because you're Cuban and you're not home.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel you're not Cuban and you're not home, does that resonate with you, or is that just your parents' generation?
It resonates to some extent. I would like to mention that in my own circumstance, my parents came when they were very young, so it only even resonates with them to a certain extent. Now, I don't want to speak for them. It does resonate with them, and for me, I think it still holds water. But I am very American as well, and I do feel home here, so it's not the same. And I'll say that if you take Cubans, even from much older generations, but who came in the first wave after Castro took over, they've been here for 40-some-odd years.
Right.
It's not that it's not home for them anymore, because it is, and that's not something that can be taken away, but there is something to be said for them living here for a good amount, a majority of their lives.
But for some in Miami, the home is actually this ideological conflict and maintaining it. You know, the Berlin Wall was this immovable object in Europe until, poof, it was a bunch of souvenirs. Yeah. Is that transformation possible in Cuba from where you're sitting?
Oh, I absolutely believe so. I don't see why that would not be the case. And I happen to know a lot of people, not only from my generation, but many from my generation, who've been working for years now starting when it was a lot harder than it is already, honestly, to make connections with people on the ground in the island and really listen to what they have to say, what their needs are, what their interests are, what they're bringing to the table, and building off of that. And I think if we're going to have a proper exchange, a fruitful exchange, it's going to have to come from that sort of interaction.
Danny Mendoza from NYU, thank you so much. And please come back when you go to Cuba and tell us what it's like. Femi Okeh is here now with the headlines.
Thanks, Lynn. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. So there's another major flooding threat for North Dakota. Valley City is along the Cheyenne River, which may crest at 22 feet this week. It's already at a record high. Bill Aberling is a National Weather Service meteorologist, and he says flooding could be a problem for the rest of spring.
Warm temperatures in the past few days warming up into the 60s. We have rapid snow melt across the entire area, which are creating high water in the rivers. We're also getting overland flooding.
Volunteers are helping sandbag in order to hold back the river. Classes have been cancelled at public schools and at Valley City State University so students can help out. Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano is expected to name a former federal prosecutor today as the country's so-called border czar. Alan Bursin will oversee issues related to drug violence and immigration along the U.S.-Mexico border. It's April the 15th, the day income taxes are due. President Obama is noting the day with a speech about the tax code later this morning. And anti-tax activists are noting the day with protests. Some are holding so-called Tea Party rallies across the country, and they're inspired by the Boston Tea Party, and they say that they're fed up with high taxes and government spending. And that's a look at some of the big stories making news this morning.
They're just fed up.
Fed up.
So they're going to throw tea into the water.
No, not necessarily. I mean, that would be a bad use of tea.
Right. Thank you.
Send it to me.
Yeah.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
And I'm Lynn Scherr, sitting in for Adora Udoji. And this is one of those good news, bad news stories. Or maybe it's just a mystery, depending on how you look at it. And when it's about the war on drugs, we all have to look at it. A new report from the Sentencing Project shows that over a six-year period, the rate of black men imprisoned for drug-related crimes has dropped 21%, while the imprisonment for white men rose by 42%. To help us understand what happened and what exactly that might mean, David Fati, director of the U.S. Program for Human Rights Watch, joins us from Washington, D.C. David, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning to you. Let's just get right to it. What are the theories for why this demographic shift has happened? How come?
Well, it's an interesting finding, and it will be interesting to see if it really ripens into a long-term trend or turns out to be more of a blip that doesn't persist. Some of the theories or hypotheses are changes in patterns of drug use by African Americans, less use of crack cocaine, changes in the drug market, different changes in police enforcement priorities. And in terms of the increase in white drug incarceration, the increasing use and arrests and prosecution for methamphetamine. So these are all hypotheses. And neither of them
sure. really is very good news. I mean, it's good news to think that perhaps one group is using fewer drugs, not such good news to think another is using more. Is there some good news in terms of the Justice Department, in terms of our legal system?
Well, it is good news that in this one area, at least, the racial disparities in our criminal justice system have, at least for temporarily, become a little less stark. But it has to be put in the context of an overall situation that remains very disturbing. The finding of this report is that blacks have gone from making up 58% of those in state prison on drug charges to 45%. So that's good news, but when you realize that blacks are only about 12% of illegal drug users, you see that there's still quite a long way to go.
Still overrepresented, but I guess the thing that's shocking to me is for such a giant shift, I mean, down 21% on the part of black men, up 42% by white men in the arrest rate or the incarceration rate, I mean, that would be some unintended consequence that's just bouncing around there. It sounds to me like the system isn't under much control at all.
Well, the system, I think that's an accurate statement, and there are these external factors like changes in police enforcement priorities and changes in drug markets that do have some effect. But again, I think it's important to place this, for better or for worse, in the larger context. Black men are still more than six times more likely than white men to be incarcerated. 10% of all black men between the ages of 25 and 39 are behind bars on any given day. So we still very much have a racial disparity problem in this country.
David, what is going on now in terms of changing drug laws in New York State? Of course, we've been living for many years under the influence of the very harsh Rockefeller drug laws. There's been some movement to change that. What about nationwide? Is there a nationwide policy, or is it still state by state?
Well, criminal justice policy is largely made on the state level, so we do have to talk state by state to some extent. But this is one area where the economic crisis may actually be a bit of good news, because states all across the country are realizing that current levels of mass incarceration, of incarcerating low-level drug offenders and other nonviolent offenders, are simply not sustainable in the current economic climate when they're faced with cutting education, cutting health care, and at the same time spending more and more on prison. So we're seeing across the country, in the state of New York and elsewhere, a real fundamental rethinking of incarceration policy that we haven't seen in many, many years. And on the federal level, Senator Jim Webb has just introduced a bill that would create a National Criminal Justice Commission to look at all of these problems, mass incarceration, racial disparities, the incarceration of the mentally ill, and make recommendations for some fundamental reforms of the way we deal with crime in this society.
And what, if anything, does it say about drug use, which is really what it gets down to, doesn't it? I mean, I understand that your concern is about disparities, racial disparities. But in fact, what most people are concerned about is drug use and how that's being dealt with.
Well, I think that's a legitimate question. And I think it's also positive that there has been more and more recognition that incarceration is not a solution to drug use, that drug use is a medical problem. It's a public health problem. And that's the most effective way to deal with it. And so we're seeing developments like drug courts. We're seeing developments like diversion for first-time, low-level drug offenders. And we're seeing a move away from the, you know, lock them up model that's been prevalent in this country for far too long.
David Fati, thank you so much for shedding some light on this fascinating topic. We should also point out that this study that we're talking about was done between 1999 and 2005. I understand it does take a while for trends to appear, but that was almost 4 years ago now. So we're going to track it and see what mysteries may come up in the next set of statistics. David Fati is the director of the U.S. program at Human Rights Watch. And Femi Okeh is here now with headlines.
Thanks, Lynn. 22 minutes to the top of the hour is the time. And in the last couple of minutes, just began some news from the Labour Department. And the Labour Department says that consumer prices have edged down 0.1% last month. That leaves inflation over the past year falling at the fastest rate in more than half a century. The Obama administration has decided to release the results of big banks' so-called stress tests to the public. The grades were originally going to be kept under wraps, but the administration didn't want rumors to affect investors' decisions. The Obama administration also says that Pakistan's implementation of Islamic law in the northwest Swat Valley goes against human rights and democracy. Here's the White House spokesman, Robert Gibbs.
The administration believes solutions involving security in Pakistan don't include less democracy and less human rights. The signing of that denoting strict Islamic law in the Swat Valley goes against both of those principles.
Pakistani President Asif Ali Zardari signed a bill yesterday that officially implements Islamic law. In exchange, the Taliban in that region promised to stop fighting the government. And thousands of troops are deployed across India trying to keep order during tomorrow's elections. With more than 1.2 billion citizens, India usually holds staggered elections for logistics and safety reasons. And tomorrow is the first of five phases that will span a month. Opinion polls predict the ruling party and the opposition will both fail to get an outright majority in Parliament. John Lynn.
714 million eligible voters out of more than a billion.
Yeah, elections that go on for a month.
Amazing. You could lose by the entire United States population.
That is possible.
Thank you, Femi.
Yeah, interesting.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Lynn Scherr, in for Adore Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And in the part of the world where they came up with the phrase canary in the coal mine, it's also one of the cloudiest places in the world, they've come up with a solution or a possible strategy for dealing with sunburn and possibly preventing the skin cancerous consequences of getting too much sun. Joining us now is Andrew Mills, professor at Strathclyde University in Glasgow. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Hi, John. Good to be here.
Now, you've developed these little thin strips called intelligent skin or fake skin filled with a kind of ink that changes colors if you've had too much exposure to ultraviolet light. Do you get much chance to test these out in Glasgow?
Wow. What they are is they're bands, basically. They're wristbands or they're patches. There's just an ink printed on paper. As for testing it, the skin cancer numbers in the UK are highly disturbing. 70,000 people contact skin cancer per year, and 2,000 of them die. So really, we're even though we don't get very much of it, we do pursue it very aggressively, too aggressively, really. And these indicators just give you an early warning to tell you to get out the sun.
Now, is this more like a canary in the coal mine where if the canary actually does keel over, there is a sign that the oxygen is getting, not enough to support life, or there's a gas in the mine, something like that? Or is this more like the turkey's little thermometer, which pops out when the turkey is done?
Yeah, maybe the latter. It's actually very reminiscent to the X-ray little photographic film they used to use when people used to have X-rays. You know, it tell you whether you've had too much of a dose of that. This thing adds up all the time during the day how much UV light you're receiving, and it will change color just before your skin is about to show signs. Well, it won't actually show signs. This is one of the problems with sunburn. It would be great if we all turned, started to show the signs of sunburn instantaneously. It takes about 4 up to 8 hours to show signs. This thing will actually show a change color just before that. So just before you receive your what they call sunburning dose or erythermal dose.
Now, is this safe for kids? I mean, there's a lot of talk of putting sunscreen on kids, yeah, using chemicals to screen out the sun.
Yes,
is the safest way for dealing with kids because it's a low maintenance option. But is something like this a real alternative, and is it safe?
Well, I certainly wouldn't say to avoid using suntan lotions. It's a complement to it, really. Is it safe? Well, it's a wristband and it's a sticky patch. It adds to the information that you'll have, so that when your kids are out there playing, you can see from the wristband or the patches, and they can see as well, whether they're receiving the dose. And then the neat little trick is that if you treat the wristband like your skin, in other words, you put suntan lotion over it, it delays its response a commensurate amount.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, yeah. Professor, before we go, is the fact that this is cumulative new, as opposed to it simply measures an exposure in instantaneous time?
There have been UV, what they call UV dosimeters or these kind of things before. What's really neat about it, there's a couple of features. Number one is it's got a really nice delay, so the color isn't gradual. It just suddenly appears, sort of pings. And finally, it's really inexpensive.
All right. Andrew Mills, professor at Strathclyde University in Glasgow, Scotland, developing wristbands with intelligent ink to detect UV exposure. Thanks, professor.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I like this. Maybe I'll sell it to the IRS. Takeaway Wednesday. It's tax day. How do you feel? You're giving a lot of information to the government. But if there were a comment box at the bottom of your 1040 this year, what would you say?
Tyrell from Baltimore. What I would say to Uncle Sam is, hey, babe, sorry you haven't gotten any money from me in a while. Only because I haven't been working for 3 years, and you probably won't get any this year because I still haven't been working, so that's the issue. What can I say? No money, no job, no tax, no file. Smile.
Nice message there. Your 1040 tweaks at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Coming up, your brain is not green. We'll tell you why right after Femi Okeh's got some headlines.
Thanks, John. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The crew of the Maersk Alabama is flying home to the United States. The Somali pirate attack survivors are on a charter plane back to America. Their captain will be right behind them. They wanted to reunite and fly together, but freed hostage Richard Phillips couldn't get back to port in time.
Can Somali pirates fly planes?
Don't even put that suggestion out there, John.
Follow them all over.
Don't even say, okay.
Could do it.
Meanwhile, the captain and the crew will have a reunion back in the United States. An American freighter was attacked yesterday. It has escaped. And now the United Nations is sounding the alarm that freighters that are carrying cargo for aid help around East Africa are being threatened by Somali pirates. Moving to Asia, today is a national holiday in North Korea, but the country's leaders are keeping very busy throwing out United Nations nuclear inspectors and pulling out of nuclear arms talks. And North Korea is ordering UN monitors to remove seals and cameras from its main nuclear complex and asking them to leave the country. In South Asia, the trial of a Pakistani suspect charged in last year's terror attacks in Mumbai, India, is now on hold. The judge says that the man's lawyer has a conflict of interest because she also represents a person wounded in the shootings. An American accused of being a Nazi death camp guard can stay in the United States for now. An appeals court is holding the deportation of John de Jumjuk to Germany for a possible war crimes trial. His legal team will have more time to make the case that sending the 89-year-old abroad would be inhumane given his fragile medical state. Oliver Nishnik is the granddaughter of John de Jumjuk, and she watched her grandfather's arrest.
I hope everybody can hope and pray that an innocent man is being treated very, very wrongly. The things that we all saw inside of that house, you guys didn't see how much pain he was in, screaming and agonizing pain. So I can only hope that maybe everybody can open up a place in their heart and pray tonight that maybe things will take a turn for the better.
And that's a look at your news for now.
Ivan the Terrible is who Demjanjuk is accused of being. That's right. So also inflation, consumer prices dipped at the fastest year-to-year rate in 50 years. But we're going to talk about what it's like to be green. In your brain, you've got a predicament. The human beings are evolved over the last 3 million years to wander around looking for food, water, and carbon to burn, to use. But now there's a change of plans afoot as climate change suggests that 6 billion of us carbon-seeking humans is actually producing enormous environmental stress. Changing plans that have been enforced for 3 million years may involve some neurons and some pretty complicated evolutionary biology. And joining us to talk about the neurological impediments to going green right in our brains is John Gertner, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. He joins us from New Jersey. John, what have you found that scientists are looking at in actual neurological terms, impediments to going green? I mean, we don't want to do it. Why?
And green can be a pretty squishy term. So if we looked at, say, climate change specifically, and we looked at different ways we look at risk or consider risk, I mean, we have two ways of sort of considering risky things. We sometimes can look at it in a very analytical way where we balance cost against benefits and sort of think about that and how it stacks up. And another way is that we're sort of very, I guess you could say, hardwired to look at risk as a feeling. We sense something as risky and we act accordingly. When we feel risk as a feeling, we usually act quickly. We usually draw on our own experience that something is dangerous, that we have to act. Unfortunately, neither one of these systems for assisting risk is that helpful in climate change. We consider it something that's far away, both in time and in place. And even when we're using our analytical systems, when we're trying to sort of balance costs and benefits, it doesn't seem to take advantage of our cognitive abilities. We have a certain kind of bias for valuing near-term costs or consumption over long-term benefits. We seem like we might be built to fail, I guess you could say.
Well, or at the very least, built to only respond to climate change when the rising waters are up around our knees. Is that what the scientists are saying?
I think, as they say, you know, immediate risk will engender immediate action, and at the moment we're not there.
Are there strategies for human beings to transfer that kind of long-term risk into some sort of a short-term urgency to change behavior, to preserve the settlement, the community, the society?
Well, a lot of our energy and a lot of our dollars goes into looking at climate change and through either the physical sciences or the biological sciences. You know, anybody who reads the science pages or even the news pages can see that, you know, week after week or month after month, we keep getting, you know, more and more information. Much of it is fairly distressing, but not a lot of dollars or focus has been on human behavior. And the question I think might be, if we get more studies or more information, does that persuade us and move us towards action? Or, as you know, I've spent the last few months with some decision scientists and behaviorists at Columbia University, is the key to addressing global warming, which is really a matter of symptoms of what we're doing. If we look at all these things like rising temperatures and species extinctions, those are symptoms of a warmer world, and the cause really is us. It's human behavior, and maybe the answer, at least in part, isn't just in technological solutions, but in looking at how we might change the way we act and think and decide to do things.
John, I'm a little bit confused. It feels counterintuitive to me, because what you're saying is if we're hardwired not to respond until the water is rising above our ankles, does that mean we can doom ourselves and then perhaps not be able to get out of it? I always had the feeling that somehow as human beings we had the ability to take care of whatever we needed to.
Well, I think if you look at the science of climate change, I think by the time, say, oceans are rising to a certain point, there's a certain amount of positive feedbacks that kind of kick in that are fairly worrisome, whether it's, you know, methane in the atmosphere I don't really necessarily think you can quickly reverse a rise in temperatures of say, you know, 3 or 5 degrees centigrade. So I think by the time climate change becomes a matter of, direct experience, what we might say is that perhaps by then it's too late to really act decisively.
Well, the National Center for Atmospheric Research has just published a study which suggests that if we were able to cut emissions of greenhouse gases by 70% in this century, that we could avoid a lot of the scientifically valid and reliable sort of consequences of climate change. And that suggests enormous behavioral changes. And I guess part of what your article is talking about is, do environmentalists suddenly think that investing in figuring out how humans perceive risk, coming up with strategies for changing behavior, are actually better investments than the kind of E.O. Wilson scare people to death to try to get them to change, that these are better investments than simply informing people like Al Gore has been doing?
It's a great question. I don't think I could begin to say that environmentalists as a whole think this. And in fact, I would say it's a sort of insurgent view, perhaps. And I also think if you look at the funding of something like the National Science Foundation, of where science dollars go in terms of climate research, it's a very tiny part. I think we're talking like 2 or 3% would go to social science research. And even if we look at that 2 or 3%, just a little sliver of that is going to sort of behavioral research. Some of it is looking at, well, how will people adapt, so to speak, to a warm world? Or how can, you know, farmers, so to speak, adapt? So I think amongst a small number of people, there's this notion that, well, you know, it's not that technology is going to be the answer, or more information or better climate models that can more precisely pinpoint exactly what the temperatures or heat waves are going to be like, but that if we're going to introduce new technologies and if we're going to introduce new policies, then maybe we need to understand a little bit what people will accept.
Well, better to be preventive, or just archaeologists figuring out why we ended up like the dinosaurs. John Gertner, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, talking about neuroscience and the limitations of human behavior and difficulty going green. What other human difficulties are we having?
Well, you know what else is on our brains today? Taxes. Yeah. It is tax day. How are you feeling? And what if you could leave a comment at the bottom of your 1040 this year? What would you say? Maybe, I took this deduction because I deserve it, or I did everything right because I'm scared of being audited.
My name is Nick Bacon. As a resident but non-citizen, every time I fill out a tax return in this country, I ask myself, whatever happened to no taxation without representation?
Oh, that old thing?
Oh, yeah. Tell us your take at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Well, I'm John Hockenberry. You are...
Lynn Scher.
This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Poverty? Not for me. It's way too expensive.
Just a minute. Is there a printing charge on this?
No.
Oh, thanks. Just a $2 delivery charge. What do you mean, delivery charge? I'm standing right next to you.
Well, for such a short distance, I make it a dollar.
Couldn't I move over here and make it 50 cents?
Yes, but I'd move over here and make it a dollar just the same.
Say, maybe I better open a charge account, huh?
You got us some references?
Well, the only one I know around here is you.
That's no good. You'll have to pay cash.
Well, in the tootsie-frootsie world of poverty, there's a fee to deposit money, to withdraw it, to use the teller window, to use the ATM. The racial economics of being forced to pay now for almost everything.
You got us some references?
That'll be $2 more on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
We're paying our fees this morning, just like the Marx Brothers. It's Wednesday, April 15th. I'm John Hockenberry. Adore Udoji is home with her new baby. Lynn Schur is here with us. Good morning, Lynn.
Hi, John. Paid my taxes.
Coming up this hour, it's tax day, so Lynn is early. She wants you all to know that. We'll give you a peek into the brains of tax cheats, the other people who are keeping the Treasury shy of cash. Also, fake sweeteners come in pink, blue, and yellow packets. It's all about what tastes sweet to your brain. Sweet. All this coming up at first headlines. Fresh new economic numbers just out in the last hour. New signs of deflation. The consumer price index is down 0.1%. The CPI is the average price of various things regular folks buy year to year. It's down by the fastest pace in half of a century. Later this hour, another key economic report. The latest numbers on industrial production. That's tied to jobs. And a lot of the stuff those factories make head to market on giant cargo ships. More piracy this morning. Somali pirates managed to attack an American ship, but the crew managed to shake the attackers, not before they blew a hole in the ship and started a fire. More on piracy later on in the hour. Femi, okay, what else is going on?
Good morning, all. More on piracy right now. You may remember that Captain Phillips was still on board when the Bainbridge came to help the other ship. The crew of Phillips's ship is taking a chartered plane back to the U.S., and Phillips was going to meet up with the rest of his crew in Kenya so they could fly back to the U.S. together, but now their reunion will take place in the U.S. U.S. Special Envoy George Mitchell is in Israel today. It's his first visit to the region since the new right-leaning government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu took power. Later this week, Mitchell will talk to Palestinians in the West Bank. North Korea is taking another step back from nuclear disarmament. It's kicking out United Nations nuclear inspectors. This follows Pyongyang's declaration it will pull out of long-running six-country arms talks.
So North Dakota bracing for another round of flooding, more layoffs at UBS, 7,500 of them. The Dow dropped nearly 2% yesterday. It starts trading at 79.20. So on this tax day, everyone, how are you feeling about the government?
My name is Nancy. I'm calling from Detroit. What I would say to the government, if I could, is thank you. Because when I think about everything that I get for my taxes, like a police and fire department, a road system, public schools, I really feel like what I pay in taxes is a very small price for everything that I get in return.
It's there in the numbers, your commentary about being a citizen of the United States. Whether you like it or not, you send a comment to the government every time you pay taxes. 877-8-MY-TAKE. What would you literally put on a comments line? Or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone, here on tax day. Yes, it's April 15th. If you haven't filled out your 1040 form, you still have some time. Yes, you still have some time, and we're here to help. Yes, we are here to help. The government, are they here to help? How do you feel about the government? We're actually looking for your comments. There's no comment line at the bottom of your 1040 form. Maybe there's a reason for that, because the comments you have about your government are actually buried in the way you do your taxes. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE with your comments. Add up all the numbers and tell us what your comment is about the government this year. Or you can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. I'm here with Lynn Schur, who's in for Adora Udoji.
Lynn Schur, who has paid her taxes. Thank you very much.
Is not a cheat, right?
Not even a little bit. I'm
right?
So honest.
And that's because you're moral, right? Because cheating is wrong, right?
Deeply
that's
moral.
That's right. Or it's because you can get punished for doing it. Is that maybe why you're not a cheat?
I'm scared of going to
jail.
Scared.
So you're scared and moral.
All
scared
of the above.
And moral. Are you a little angry about the government and AIG bailouts?
Only
and
about no? some of it.
Causes
yeah.
you maybe
yeah. a little
to
sense
sort
of betrayal.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
That, yeah, maybe that you'll change the addition maybe on your taxes.
Could I just go back and say I filed my taxes and I'm honest?
Trying to avoid an audit here on The Takeaway is Lynn Schur. Joining us now is Dan Ariely, James B. Duke Professor of Behavioral Economics at Duke University, author of Predictably Irrational. He joins us from Toronto this morning. So I guess you're up there in Canada to escape the IRS, Dan?
Yes, just in case after this talk they want to audit me.
I see. Very good. Well, it's a multi-billion dollar question whether Americans are inclined to pay their taxes because of the way they feel about the government or inclined to cheat, not report, ask for too many deductions because the tax system is voluntary. And so the behavior of Americans bears directly on what the IRS takes in. What is the likelihood that Americans will cheat on their taxes, especially in these challenging economic times, Dan?
100%.
100%? Really?
So every year, the IRS, basically last year, they thought that they didn't get about $360 billion compared to what they expected to get. So this is not a new phenomenon. We're not just talking about this one year.
Sure.
But I think this year might be particularly interesting because of exactly what you said, that when people are thinking about the taxes, the tax code is so ambiguous. It's so difficult, you know. You go out for dinner with somebody and you talk about work. Is this a dinner expense? Is this a business expense all of a sudden? The tax code is so long and so complex that it leaves a lot for our interpretation, a little bit like financial instruments. And in the same way, when people have this ambiguity, the question is, how are they going to interpret their situation? And we've done all kinds of studies showing that when people are angry and revengeful, they are more likely to reinterpret the information in a way that is selfishly good for them. And I think this could happen this year when the tax gap, the difference between what the IRS think they should get and what they actually would get, will go even higher.
Now, this is something that you've studied scientifically. And I guess the question is, based on your research, is there anything you can do to the actual tax form itself? Change the color of it, make it, squeak if you do something wrong, or change the font on the tax form that would actually discourage people from cheating or cause them to think again?
So I think there are kind of two interesting answers to this. The first one is we've done all kind of studies showing that when people sign up front rather than sign at the end, they become more honest.
Really?
And Whoa. The idea is that the signature gets people to think about their own morality. So we can get you to sign at the top. We can ask you to say, how did your parents raise you? How important was honesty to them? But perhaps a more interesting one is to replace the first question on a tax form and ask people whether they would contribute $25 to a fund to find corruption and dishonesty. And if you answer yes to that form, then you've just committed to being honest and fighting corruption, and you might continue doing so.
$25?
And if you answer no, $15, okay, I'll give you this.
All right, fine. But you've actually done experiments where these kinds of pledges and signing at the top and a sort of a get everyone committed to anti-corruption actually does predict whether people are likely to cheat or not, right?
That's right. So we did some studies, for example, with insurance form that people declare how many miles they drove last year. And if they sign at the top of the form, they basically are 15% more honest than if they sign at the bottom of the form. So there's a big difference, which is kind of similar to the tax gap in terms of percentage. But I do have one more idea, which I think is actually more important. When I first filled my taxes, I thought this was just a great American procedure, a ritual, that once a year you get to think about your income, you get to think about your taxes. You get to think about your government, what's good about it, what's bad about it. If you need to be angry, you'll get angry. I thought it's kind of a great idea for civil engagement. But over the years, I realized that the way the tax code and the complexity is so on, it's not a civil engagement exercise at all. Instead, what happened is it's just a fight with the numbers and frustration and anger with all this complexity. So I think that if we made the tax code simpler to start with, and on top of that, we gave people a chance to say, look, here's 5% of your tax money. How do you want to allocate it as a citizen? Tell us how you think it should be. I mean, roads, infrastructure, green energy, education, research, whatever it is.
Rebate.
It would give it back, make it back into rebate. It would make it back into a civil engagement exercise, which I think is could potentially be so important and useful.
Let me ask you this. You're talking about the people who do file, and these sound like cool ideas. What percentage of people are out there still who don't file at all because they don't believe that the income tax is legal? Any number of them go to jail every year, but aren't there a lot of people who just say, I'm not filing, I don't have to?
It's a very small amount. It's a very, very small amount who are big cheaters. In fact, this is kind of something we find very generally, is that we make lots of headlines and pay a lot of attention to the bad apples. You can think about Madoff and so on. People who don't pay their taxes. But the majority of the financial burden of cheating doesn't come from those individuals who don't pay at all. It comes from lots of people who are just shading their taxes just by a little bit.
So it's that little bit shading that is really, really the economic drain on the IRS. Okay, I'm doing some math here, Dan. You have scientific data that suggests that a 15% reduction in tax cheating could possibly accrue by simply putting the sign line on the 1040 form at the top versus the bottom. That's what you've just told us, right?
We did it with a different form, but the implication is that we could have similar ideas.
So have you called the IRS and said, hey, guys, simple tweak, 15% cash money?
I did. I actually called the IRS first when we found these results with the students. And, well, they said they have better things to do. And they're probably right.
So, and by the way, how much does it cost to reprint all the tax forms and move the signature up to the top? That's got to be a bit of a price, right?
I don't think so. You know, they have to print new forms every year anyway.
I know.
And they change them. But
we have better things to do.
Nice. To talk to me. Are you trying to get me into trouble here?
No, actually, you should at least apply for a grant. Go to the NSF and say, well, if the IRS won't listen to me, I should at least get $50 million to investigate this.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that the IRS is actually very worried about their image. You know, everybody has a kind of a really bad feeling about them. I mean, imagine you worked for the IRS and you went to a cocktail party and somebody said, what do you do? And you said, I work for the IRS. How would you feel about it, right? It's very, very tough. So, in fact, they're doing lots of efforts to try and be good to people. They are spending lots of money trying to investigate all the people who are mistakenly overpay their taxes, particularly people from low SES groups. They're spending a lot of effort trying to get lots of tax preparers that overcharge, again, particularly poor people for tax preparation and the confusion in what they're doing. So they're actually spending a lot of effort trying to be good rather than trying to be cops.
Well, in fact, the IRS head, the head of the IRS, I've heard him on a number of interviews, both television and radio, saying, look, if you can't pay, it's all right. Just send in the form. You know, we'll get back to you. We're going to work with you. Does that help to reduce cheating? Does that actually result in any sort of monetary benefit, or is it simply about allowing those people to actually talk to people at cocktail parties?
Yeah, no, I think it doesn't help. I mean, the IRS, part of its charm is its fear. And when the fear goes away, some of the teeth go away as well. And there was
So then there is no way for them to improve their image. If you're saying they operate on fear, then they can't blow that, right?
I think they need to operate on civil engagement, right? But basically saying they're not really improving their image by saying we're nice people, and they're taking the stick away. I think the right way is to get us to feel somehow that this is a social commitment that we all need to be in some way. It's like a run on the bank. If we all decide to pay less, we're all suffering from it. And if we all decide to contribute, everybody is benefiting.
Now, isn't that a little pie in the sky, though, that tax time is going to become this sort of ritual of thinking about citizenship and, gosh, aren't we great Americans here?
It is, but isn't it nice to at least strive for it?
It works better. I mean, if they won't move the line where you sign for 15% increase in taxes,
at least the 5% contribution. Yeah.
And it sounds very Obama-esque. Dan Ariely, of course, James B. Duke Professor of Behavioral Economics at Duke University and author of Predictably Irrational in the diaspora there up there in Toronto, Canada. Avoiding the IRS? No, not Dan. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you. Take care.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, folks. Call it Takeaway Day if you dare. It is tax day, April 15th. How are you feeling? Well, if you're like Dan Ariely, you know, maybe you signed your taxes at the bottom and have a sense of relief. But what if there were a comment box at the bottom of your 1040 where you could tell the IRS exactly what was on your mind? What would you get off your chest? Teresa writes on our site, I would say that I don't think they're supportive enough or honest enough with citizens serving in the military. When my husband joined the Army Reserves, he was promised $50,000 toward his student loan debt. They failed to mention that the amount would really be more like $40,000 after taxes are taken out. Tell us your 1040 tweaks or comments for the U.S. government at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. It's all there in the numbers. So take a taste of this right now. That's sweet, sweet. There's a lot of brain activity involved with sweets. When something's sweet, it is so good. And what are you putting in your coffee this morning? Is it black and pink? Is it with sugar, or is it with some sort of artificial sweetener? And they're proliferating these days. Kim Severson, one of New York Times crack food writer team, joins us. She's our pal here at The Takeaway. She's in the studio in honor, I should say, of the introduction of Stevia, brand new artificial sweetener, calorie-free, natural artificial sweetener. I hope you'll explain what that is to me. All right, let me try some here, mixed with water. It tastes sweet, a little non-sugary, kind of a artificially taste, but it still motivates the question, why do we need another artificial sweetener, Kim? And what is it that artificial sweeteners do to your tongue and brain that sugar doesn't?
The whole point of an artificial sweetener, obviously, big thing for diabetics, is a big thing for people who are concerned about weight loss. The Atkins and the low-carb diet craze certainly did a lot for the artificial sweetener market. But now we're moving into natural. People want natural. You know, there's always been some questions, most of them unfounded, but certainly there are a lot of questions around how safe artificial sweeteners are. I couldn't find anything that said that it's, you know, a terrible thing. That's gonna give you a brain problems. Although certainly if you go online, you'll find a lot of people who feel differently than that. But anyway, this feeling is that there's this natural thing called stevia. It's a plant that is native to South America, and a couple of large companies, Cargill and a few others, have figured out a way to extract a certain kind of sweetness from the leaf. You'll notice if you taste it that it has just a little bit of back taste on it.
This is actually the
stevia
envelope here.
Right. This is one.
The brand is Truvia.
There are a couple more brands that are out. There's something called Purevia. That's the PepsiCo partnership. Coca-Cola and Cargill teamed up to make this particular thing. Stevia has been around as a dietary supplement, and certainly your friends who are health food nuts may have had some of it. The problem is it's got a kind of a really bad licorice menthol aftertaste, and it's a little slow to get sweet. So it was always kind of hard to control, and it was kind of awful. It was sold as a dietary supplement. The FDA wouldn't let it be sold as a food supplement. But now, as of December of 2008, you can have this in your food. So that's, they think, this product, they think, is really going to shake up what's a $1.2 billion artificial sweetener.
How about
business.
For cooking? Does it work for cooking as well?
They say this can work for cooking. I haven't cooked with it. I've certainly cooked with Splenda, which came out in the 90s. It was quite big in the 90s. And they said you could use it spoon for spoon. Now, I don't know if you've ever tasted something baked with Splenda. It's close, but it certainly tastes something that is not like sugar.
No, you can bake with it, but you can't like caramelize with Splenda.
No, you cannot. Although they do now have Splenda that's like a brown sugar, and they also have Splenda now with added fiber. So if you need that, it's amazing.
Maybe with calcium soon and
fluoride.
Who knows? Yeah.
Why aren't you working for a chemical company?
Here's the thing that is so fascinating about your article, and that is that there's a kind of identification, a sort of brand loyalty to artificial sweeteners that goes way beyond simply alternative to sugar. I mean, there are people who swear by Sweet and Low. Here's the little pink.
Right.
Sweet and Low. It's been around forever.
This is the oldest.
Why is that?
Well, you know, people really, it's very funny. They were trying to imitate sugar, and there's one taste receptor in your mouth that has that registers sugar. And they've been trying to replicate that with all these chemicals for a very long time, and they haven't been able to figure out how to do that. I'm afraid that if they do, people will be like, no, it tastes too much like sugar. I want my artificial sweetener, because we've trained an entire generation of people to have this taste.
That's from the soft drinks, though, right? That's from all the diet sodas.
Some of it. Certainly aspartame is in most of the diet sodas,
right,
and that's
right.
The blue
also
Equal
called
pack.
NutraSweet. Yeah.
You know,
right.
And NutraSweet, which used to be the same company, now they're split up. But that aspartame flavor, it's a really sharp Sweetness. It's got a specific flavor. People have gotten trained for that. You remember just for the taste of it, Diet Coke, 1980s ad campaign. That was a whole big thing. But there are some people who love Sweet and Low. You find somebody and you try to give them a blue pack and they want their Sweet and Low and they're going to reject it.
At home, I now have to keep all separate ones for everybody.
Right. The poor diner waitress who's got to have every packet in her apron or the customers are going to be happy.
Now, here's another thing that's coming down the pike. I'm tasting this. It's called NutraSweet Cane.
Right.
Now, why would you have an artificial sweetener with sugar? That seems ridiculous.
Well, you are certainly behind the times, Mr. Hockenberry. The idea is to blend. The brave new future of sweeteners is blending. So you get a little bit of sugar to soften that kind of, artificial flavor. It's not that many. This has, I think, 5 calories. And just to note, if something has less than 4 calories or less, it can still be called no calorie. It's a quirk of the FDA, as an aside thing.
Well, but isn't it a sugar? Aren't we in sort of sugar mode now because of the economic situation? Isn't it part of the whole comfort food, go back to sugar? People want that sweetness.
Say what you told me this morning. Since the recession began, you have every night
eaten French fries.
Comfort food.
I'm in total meatloaf, mashed potatoes, French fries mode.
But that means sugar is in.
We are eating a lot of sugar. And actually, sugar's being, I wrote about this in the New York Times a few weeks ago, sugar is the new health food. It's seen as an alternative. You can tell where the sugar's coming from. It's the cane, and then it's the sugar in your bowl. People are wanting shorter supply chains. They want healthier food. So sugar, pure cane sugar, it has this aura about it, this sort of green aura now compared to high fructose corn syrup.
Although
so
there are health implications on diabetes, which
sugar was considered heroin for many, this idea that it's just fantastic how it's all switched now.
Well, you can go to our website and see Kim Severson's sugar substitute alternatives, and I count here 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Also, stevia, right?
Correct. I'm just saying, make sure that you compare the Splenda to the new NutraSweet Yellow, and let me know which is better.
All right. Okay, so here we go. So this is Splenda. Mm-hmm. And this is NutraSweet Cane. Ah, can't beat sugar. Artificial sweeteners, the culture, the neuroscience, the sweetness of it all. New York Times food writer Kim Severson, thanks so much for joining us. Femi Okay has some headlines now. So sweet.
So sweet, I'm going to rot your teeth 29 minutes past the hour.
So negative.
Thank you, John. That was a lovely compliment. I appreciate that.
In a positive way.
In a very positive way. U.S. industrial production falls by 1.5% in March. That's much higher than analysts expected. And earlier today, we had some figures from the Labor Department, and the department reported that the Consumer Price Index, or CPI, dipped 0.1% last month. So that means that inflation is falling at the fastest pace in more than 50 years. The drop was unexpected. Analysts expected it to rise a little bit. And rescued Captain Richard Phillips was still aboard the USS Bainbridge when it came to the rescue of the latest ship that was hijacked or attempted to be hijacked by Somali pirates. He's on his way home.
More pirate activity. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
And I'm Lynn Scher, sitting in for Adora Udoji. And it is the best of times, it is the worst of times. Perhaps you've read that sentence or one like it in a novel. Well, President Obama gave us his own version yesterday in a speech at Georgetown University in Washington. Times are tough, he said. Then he talked about seeing the light at the end of the tunnel.
There's no doubt that times are still tough. By no means are we out of the woods just yet. But from where we stand, for the very first time, we're beginning to see glimmers of hope. And beyond that, way off in the distance, we can see a vision of an America's future that is far different than our troubled economic past.
So, which one is it? Have we seen the worst of times, or is that yet to come? Is it better to get the bad news straight without any sort of coating on it? Maybe something along the lines of what President Carter gave us in what came to be known as his Meles speech in 1979.
This cannot be an inspirational speech tonight. I don't expect much applause. It's a sober and a difficult presentation.
And indeed, in time, he did not get much applause, and that was very different from all those sunny side up speeches from Ronald Reagan. What is the best way to cope emotionally and stay on an even keel in turbulent economic times? And for that, we are joined by Annie McKee, founder of the global consulting firm Teleios Leadership Institute. First of all, welcome. And tell me, should the President of the United States be telling us how to feel about the economy? Does that work?
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for having me on today. It's an interesting question about whether our president should be telling us how to feel. I think most of us out here know how we feel. We're scared. We're panicked. Some of us have lost our jobs, our homes, our cars. We have no idea what's coming down the pike. You know, for maybe the first time in our lives, we can't predict the future with respect to our own livelihood and the economy of our nation. It doesn't look good. But most of us know deep in our hearts that what gets us through times like this is hope. I mean, think about it. If you've had a tragedy in your life, if you've had something really bad happen, you wake up in the morning and you feel despair and you feel sadness and you feel grief. What gets you out of bed is getting past that by thinking about the future.
And actually, is that hope something that's meant to come from the leader of the country?
I think it's partly the responsibility of all of us who lead people to inspire the people who depend on us with a realistic vision of the current state, which I believe President Barack Obama is doing, but also give us a vision of where we might go. And by the way, I don't think that vision of an America that's very different than the one we've known is all that comforting, because we are going to be living a different lifestyle. We're going to have to give things up. We're going to live simpler. We're going to have smaller, slower cars. You know, all of those things are in our future, and they're not going to be easy. You know, neurologically speaking, there are certain states of mind that give us strength, that allow us to literally open our minds, think more clearly, be more creative, be more innovative, be more resilient. And the state of hope is one of those. So whether a message of hope comes from Barack Obama or our local mayor or, you know, our mothers or fathers or our friends or our relatives, it's got to come from somewhere, because it's what's going to get us through.
Although, Annie McKee, it seems to me that at this particular point, the hope is coming from Americans who want this new president to succeed. It doesn't seem to me that Barack Obama necessarily is the source of hope. He's the beneficiary of hope.
Could be. He certainly had that, you know, the very clear message, you know, as long as 2 years ago and even further back, that this is the platform he's going to stand on. And in fact, little did we know how badly we'd need it. I don't think we should rely on our President Obama or anybody else to fill us up. We need to do this ourselves. Sure, it's great to hear that there is a glimmer of light at the end of the tunnel. I sure hope there is. But I think between now and when we see that light, it's going to get a lot worse. So we've got to find our own source of hope.
And you said it was a clear message from the beginning. My take on it is that, in fact, what the president is now giving us is a bit of a mixed message. Jimmy Carter, as disastrous as that speech turned out to be, at least kept his message clear. Are you at all concerned that the American public is going to be confused about this? I mean, he said we're not out of the woods yet, and yet, essentially, my words, not his, go spend your money. We need you to spend your money. Which one are we supposed to be thinking about?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think it is a mixed message in the economy right now, frankly. I don't think there is certainty.
And what should the leader of the country be doing? Is that mixed message a good idea in what is a very fragile and an uncertain economic time? Or should it be a Ronald Reagan-esque, come on, guys, you know, it's the best of times?
Well, it isn't the best of times. And anybody who says that would look like a fool. The reality is we're in a period that none of us truly understand. I mean, we can blame the certain, you know, the economic situation on the credit crisis, et cetera. I think it goes deeper than that. I think it goes back decades. And, you know, sort of over time, we in the United States and elsewhere in the world have learned to basically build our house on a pile of sand, as President Obama said yesterday. And that's got to change.
Annie McKee is the founder of the global consulting firm Teleios Leadership Institute, joining us from Philadelphia. Thanks so much for joining us, Annie. And now we're joined by Femi Okeh with the headlines.
Hello there, Lynn. The time is 22 minutes to the top of the hour. The Obama administration has decided to release the results of Big Bank's so-called stress test to the public. The grades were originally going to be kept under wraps, but the administration didn't want rumors to affect investor decisions. Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano is expected to name Alan Bursin as the America's so-called border czar. He's a former federal prosecutor who worked on illegal immigration issues back in the 1990s. And Bursin will oversee issues relating to drug violence and immigration along the U.S.-Mexico border.
He's not like a greeter. You come to the border of Tijuana and there's the czar. Yeah.
I think that the czar will have minions who will do the greeting, and he will
be
up in his
czar, special
palace.
Czar,
yes.
Greeters.
Yeah.
Okay.
North Korea is expelling United Nations nuclear inspectors. It's ordering them to remove seals and cameras from its nuclear facility and leave quickly. Meanwhile, the White House hasn't given up hope of being able to restart talks with North Korea. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs wants North Korea to come back to the six-country bargaining table.
The United States is prepared to work with North Korea and its neighbors through the six-party process to reduce tensions and achieve the elimination of nuclear weapons from the Korean Peninsula.
The expulsion of UN staff from North Korea comes after the UN Security Council's condemnation of the North's recent rocket launch. That's your news, John.
Take a look at the calendar. One more headline. It's tax day. Would you send a comment to the U.S. government?
My name's Chris. I'm calling from the Detroit metro area, and I would write a note to the government saying thank you as well for the services that are provided, and maybe a little pep note to go along with it to say, come on, boys, let's step it up and do a better job in 2009.
If you're writing a check to the government or getting a refund, what's your comment to the U.S. government? It's all there in the numbers, how you feel about being a citizen. Send us your 1040 tweaks at 877-8MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Lynn Scher.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And you say you don't like to play with numbers, but I love the numbers in this next story. Okay, in 2008, if you got 70 million votes, you won the presidential election in the United States. If you got, in the largest democracy in the world, though, if you got 320 million votes, that's more than the entire population of the United States.
Did you do that math?
You would still lose. You would still lose. You would lose. There are 714 million eligible Indian voters who head to the polls in the largest democracy in the world starting tomorrow. Joining us to set up the elections and what's at stake is Somini Sengupta, New York Times South Asia Bureau Chief in Hyderabad, India. First of all, what are the major issues in this election? And it seems to me that the target has really shifted over the last few months. I mean, we're talking about something very, very different as recently as 6 months ago in this election.
I mean, as you mentioned, there are 714 million voters going to the polls starting tomorrow. These elections are going to continue over the next 5 weeks. And because this is such a vast country, it's got so many different local issues that there are very few overarching national issues that people are voting on. The overarching national issues are very generally the economy, prospects for a better life, improving, you know, the lives of very poor people, national security, terror. Those are, you know, somewhat on the radar, but really these are a set of a bunch of local elections with local players, local personalities, local issues.
Well, Somini, what constitutes a mandate in India then? With 714 million eligible voters, I mean, you could lose by an amount that exceeds the size of the population of the United States.
this is a parliamentary system. So really what people are electing are their members of parliament. There are 543 members and elected members of the parliament, the lower house. And so in the state that I'm in right now, in Andhra Pradesh, where the elections begin tomorrow, there are, for example, 42 parliamentary seats. So you're going to go vote for your member of parliament, who will then go to the nation's capital and sit as part of this legislature. So it is true that in some places, a member of parliament can win or lose by a very big margin or a very small margin. But it's not like 714 million people are going to choose between two presidential candidates.
Right, right.
That's not how this election works.
The rate of growth in India has remained in the positive column along with China. Does the economy constitute a positive issue for any candidate in this election, or are people depressed by the amount of decline that has actually taken place compared to what we were talking about just a year ago?
Party, which is called the Indian National Congress, they have made it a point to say during our five-year tenure, the Indian economy has done really well. It has, in fact, clocked an average of almost 9% growth. That's phenomenal. Now, it's very clear that growth rates are plummeting, have already plummeted. But again, the ruling party says, we will take you through. We have weathered this storm, and we will take you through this crisis, whereas the opposition, understandably, is saying that that they have placed you in an insecure
right.
position. So trust us with the government next time around.
Well, will trust be on the minds of Indian voters when they go to the polls tomorrow? My guest is Somini Sengupta, the New York Times South Asia bureau chief, reporting from Hyderabad.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Coming up, calculating the cost of living in poverty. In just a moment, it's part of our Color of Money segment, but first, Femi Okeh has some headlines.
At 12 minutes to the top of the hour, President Obama will mark today's tax deadline with a speech on the tax code and providing tax breaks for working families. We have some new numbers out this morning showing that U.S. industrial production fell by 1.5% in March, and this is the fifth straight month of declines. And then earlier on this morning, the Labor Department reported that the Consumer Price Index, or CPI, dipped 0.1%, and that means that inflation is falling at the fastest pace in more than 50 years. George Mitchell, the U.S. Special Envoy to the Middle East, is in Israel today. It's his first visit there since Conservative Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu took power last month. Mitchell favors creating an independent Palestinian state, and Netanyahu, though, is not endorsing that idea. An American accused of being a Nazi death camp guard can stay in the United States for now. An appeals court is holding the deportation of John Demjanjuk to Germany. For a possible war crimes trial. His legal team will have more time to make the case that sending the 89-year-old abroad would be inhumane given his fragile medical state.
Of course, he's under a death sentence in Israel, you know, for being Ivan the Terrible. It's Sobibor.
Right, and this episode that's been going on for about 10 years.
Longest extradition human rights trial in world history. That's true.
Absolutely. And that's a look at some of the big stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi. Mo money, mo problems. More like no money, big problems. That's a Grammy-nominated second single and 10th track on the first disc of the notorious B.I.G. album, Life After Death. And it's the theme of our series this week, The Color of Money. If you live in communities of color, like, say, in Harlem, in Compton, California, in Detroit, Michigan, you may think that the color of money in this economic downturn is more red with all the fees that you're charged or the ad campaigns that you've maybe witnessed, like this one.
This is Russell Simmons, successful entrepreneur and philanthropist. He thinks everyone should be financially empowered. So he developed the Rush Card. It's a prepaid Visa card. There's no credit check. Everyone is eligible to sign up. You don't even need a bank account.
You don't even need a bank account. Welcoming back to the program now, Dr. Boyce Watkins, professor of finance at Syracuse University and founder of YourBlackWorld.com. He's in Oswego, New York this morning. Dr. Watkins, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here.
In this economic downturn, is it fair to ask the question, what is the color of money for communities of color, that you get an ad like that from, Russell Simmons, who's someone with a lot of credibility in the African-American community, offering a no-credit check, anyone can get a Visa card, is that a good deal?
Well, I'll say this. Russell would not be able to make money from this card if he were not fulfilling a need that isn't currently being filled by someone else. So I don't think Russell's the devil, but I don't think he's the philanthropist that he's proclaiming himself to be. I think that this title of him being a philanthropist and wanting to empower people is really sort of a preemptive strike against those who are going to accuse him of exploiting a community that has a fundamental historical problem with having access to capital, access to checking accounts, access to many of the basic services that many of us are able to obtain as Americans.
All right, well, let's talk about this. You've got a combination of people underserved by the banking community in communities of color, African-American communities, places that I've just sort of mentioned. And as a substitute, it actually costs money to be poor. How does that work when you pay a fee to actually be at the low end of the economic spectrum?
Well, if you go back to the idea that, you know, if a man is in the desert and he's thirsty, then he'll pay $10 to get a sip of water, even if he only has $10 in his pocket. And so, it's a very interesting sort of idea here. He's saying, I'm giving everyone access to the American dream, but I never really knew that the American dream consisted of having a piece of plastic that puts people further and further in debt. But even a pimp that helps, quote unquote, helps a young girl get off the street, he can say, I helped you because you were homeless when I met you and now you're not. And so she may actually have to agree with that. And so if you look at the way the Rush Card or Rush Card is structured, there are a lot of fees on this card that don't exist for other cards. For example, there's a 1995 activation fee, which doesn't exist on most bank cards. There's a $1 a day convenience fee, which I don't know exactly why you're paying for convenience, but you are. There are fees for ATM cash withdrawals. They go above and beyond regular ATM fees. I mean, the list goes on and on.
Well, are you calling Russell Simmons a pimp?
No, I will say that... well, maybe I am. I don't know. I'll let you be the judge. Yeah. But what I'll say is that I don't think Russell's a bad person per se. I will say, though, that if we want to put Russell in a different business, I think that other entities should maybe go a step further than Russell and actually solve the problem that Russell claims that he's dealing with. You know, the analogy might be that someone used this with me the other day, a guy named Ryan Mack. He said, well, it's sort of like saying if you got a cavity on the left side of your mouth, you should chew with your right. Instead, why not actually dig to the root of the issue and deal with the financial literacy problems that exist in the black community? Why not deal with the lack of basic services that, you know, President Obama and his administration could actually play a role in helping to fulfill? And then at the very least, the Rush Card might still exist, but the fees would be lower and more acceptable.
Yeah, you've almost answered the question I was about to ask, which is, isn't there some call for getting these services to people in these communities? And why shouldn't African-American businessmen, stars, people who've made a lot of money, why shouldn't they be going in and trying to make money out of something that is legitimate?
Well, absolutely. And that's why I say that, you know, when I jokingly allow people to refer to Russell as a pimp, I don't disagree with them when they say that. At the same time, I say, well, you know, pimps wouldn't have much business if there were someone there to actually help the prostitutes. You know, and the analogy could be that if if you know the Obama administration and other groups were to step in, and or if these banks were to step in and realize how much profitability exists in these underserved communities, then that would create that competition that
well,
we need.
But you know, let me give you the kind of Glenn Beck freak out question here, okay, Professor Watkins? I mean, you know, and I don't go along with Glenn Beck, but there are plenty of people who would say that, okay, if you're trying to get a jumbo mortgage but have credit problems, you have to pay more money up front, that fees aren't necessarily race-oriented. They basically reflect an issue. If you're a higher credit risk, you have to pay more money up front, and the fees are all about that. What do you say to that argument?
Well, I would say that he's right to a point. Paying a higher fee, it can certainly be justified if your credit is poor. The question is, how much higher should that fee be?
Right.
You know, it's like if I say to you, well, my daughter should be punished for not doing her homework, you would agree. But if I were to stab my daughter, you'd say, well, hey, maybe you went over the top. And so
I wouldn't say maybe. I don't think I would say maybe.
Exactly. But I love my daughter. I wouldn't do that. But what I'll say is that, you know, these fees, they certainly should be higher for those who have poor credit problems. But what happens is that, because the communities are so underserved and the lack of access to capital is so critical, the fees end up being far higher than they actually should be. And that's really where the challenge is. I don't think Russell should be out of business. I just think he should have a little more competition.
Well, you'll be talking to Russell for the rest of the day, that's for sure. But, you know, we got to
go. Yeah, he's going to be mad at me.
We got to go. But, you know, I love the things that you do with numbers, Professor Watkins. And maybe next time we talk, we could together design a kind of cost of poverty. You know, there's a cost of living index, but I'm wondering if there's a cost of poverty index that you could add up these fees and sort of create a cost of living in one of these communities of color. Dr. Watkins, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Always glad to be here.
It's Dr. Boyce Watkins, professor of finance at Syracuse University, founder of YourBlackWorld.com in our series, The Color of Money, right here on The Takeaway.
And check the calendar, folks. It's April 15th. You knew that, right? Tax day. Whoopee. Well, what if there were
you're too happy about that.
It's because I'm done, you know? I'm done. Have you all heard that I've turned in my taxes already?
Yes.
Right. Have I mentioned that?
Kind of a teacher's pet.
No audits here. Well, what if there were a comment box at the bottom of your 1040 form? What would you say? Tell us your 1040 tweaks at our website, thetakeaway.org.
And if the IRS wants people to be more honest as they fill out their 1040 form, well, here's the takeaway.
When people sign up front rather than sign at the end, they become more honest. And the idea is that the signature gets people to think about their own morality.
Yeah, but what does the IRS think of that? We have better things to do. Podcast the Dan Ariely interview. He's a professor at Duke University and author of Predictably Irrational. You can go to our website and sign up for our podcast and find another way, learn another way to be honest.
Hi, this is Mike from New York. I have an idea for the tax code. How about everybody submit their worksheets? When you show your work, it's harder to cheat.
Not bad. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Lynn Scher.
This is The Takeaway.
Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.